All right. Good morning, everybody. Good to see everybody this morning. As I said earlier, it's officially March, which means spring is here, Easter is around the corner, and for us, that means a bit of a shift in our sermon series. We're still going to be in this series, Kingdom Come, still going to be looking at the book of Matthew, but we're going to skip ahead just a bit in our story. We're going to move forward just a little bit from where we were at. Last week, we finished up chapter 21, or chapter 20, one of those two. We were at 21 or just finished 21. So that's where we were last week. And where we should be at today, if we continue on just following verse by verse, would be the triumphal entry of chapter 21 is where we should be. And so this would begin today, if you're following Matthew's gospel, the final week of Jesus' life, essentially. And for us, that would take from now until the end of the summer to get through. And you say, well, that's a long time to cover 1 week's worth of stuff. Well, that's the way the gospel writers do it so often. John does it this way. Mark does it this way. Matthew does it this way. A good quarter of Matthew's gospel is dedicated to this 1 week of Jesus' life. And so there's a lot that is there, and that will take us to the end of the summer. But what we wanted to do, instead of getting just a couple days into this last little bit of Jesus's, or this last week of Jesus's life, we wanted to fast forward just a little bit so that on Easter Sunday we finish with the resurrection, which is in Matthew chapter 28. So we're going to move forward just a bit to chapter 26. And then what we will do after that is we will come back and we will cover the rest of the last week of Jesus' life immediately following Easter, and that will take us through the summer. So hopefully that's clear as mud and you guys are good to go from there. But what you need to know today is Matthew 26 is where we're going to be, and we're going to make this work. So God has got a lot for us, and so let's get to work and seeing what it is that that we want to see. This morning, we're going to look at two stories that Matthew gives us that I don't know could be more stark in their contrast to each other. I think Matthew sets them next to each other. In fact, kind of bookends this one story with another. I think he sets them next to each other specifically because of this contrast. When I was 19, when I was 18 and looking to buy an engagement ring for my wife, which I realize now as a parent that sounds horrific, but for us that sounded like that made a lot of sense. And so no lie, had saved my lunch money all through high school for this thing, and was going to buy it. And lunch money in high school does not buy a great ring, so it is what it is. But went to buy a ring and wanted to do all I could to buy a really nice ring for her. And so went to the jeweler, and the jeweler started laying stuff out, and as meager as my budget was, still wanted to get a nice diamond. And what the jeweler would do is take the diamond out, put it on the black velvet. You know what I'm talking about? Like the very dark, very black kind of just velvet card that they'll sit it out underneath these super high-powered lights that make everything sparkle, make everything look great. And it's designed, they know what they're doing, to make the diamond look as good as it possibly can. The sparkle and the gleam of the diamond against that black setting behind it makes it even brighter. And I think Matthew is taking a page from the jeweler's book here. He's going to set these two against each other because one will look even brighter in the midst of the blackness that we see from the story right next to it. And so we're going to look at two different people, two different stories with two very different agenda. One is probably named Mary. Matthew doesn't tell us, but judging and comparing it to the same story that you can find in John's gospel, it's probably Mary. And the other is a guy named Judas. Now maybe you've heard of this guy named Judas. I'm guessing that you have, even if you have never set foot in church, even if you have never read a Bible, even if you know nothing about Christianity, you probably, if you're at least from America, have heard of this guy Judas. Judas is perhaps the most infamous person in all of history. I wonder what comes to your mind when you hear the name Judas. There's certainly no one more infamous in Scripture probably no one more infamous in all of history. So what comes to your mind? Is it betrayal? Is it money? You start seeing kind of dollar signs flashing just a little bit. Maybe it's the kiss that betrays a friend. Regardless, when you hear his name, you probably don't see him or think in yourself as, this is one of those guys in Scripture I should feel sorry for, that I should kind of have a soft spot in my heart for. Nobody says, poor old Judas. He just got mixed up with the wrong crowd. He just got with the wrong guys. And nobody says, man, that poor Judas, he just made a couple of bad choices and it ruined his reputation. He was really a pretty good guy. Nobody says that. Not even the gospel writers, whenever they talk about Judas, say this. Anytime that Judas is mentioned throughout the gospels, almost anytime, the writers of the gospels don't miss a chance to kind of get a jab at him. So like they'll list all the apostles. You got Peter and James and John and Matthew and Judas who betrayed him. Like that's his last name. That's how it finishes up. Or Judas who was a thief. Like they always, anytime they have a chance, they're going to give just that little uppercut to him, and they're not going to let him get away with ever being named without having some sort of something like that attached to him. So nobody says, good old Judas, we really liked him. We were surprised whenever we found out what he did. He just made a couple of bad choices. Nobody gives him a break. They just don't give him the chance. They throw him under the bus whenever they can. And it can be easy for us to just kind of dismiss Judas. We read the account, we say, yep, there's Judas, bad dude. I'm not like Judas. I don't want to be anything like Judas. God, don't let me be like Judas. Let's just move on. Judas is bad. I'm not Judas. We're fine. It can be easy to dismiss him, make him the villain of history, and move on. But in my opinion, that would be at our own peril. You see, when you compare these two stories, what you start to see is that you have this one woman, Mary, who is incredibly faithful, and this one guy, Judas, who betrays Jesus. And as I read these stories, what I start to realize is that far too often in my heart and in my life, I can identify more with Judas than I can with Mary. And if we miss that and we move past that, I think we really miss an important lesson for us. So let's read the beginning of this chapter, and what we'll do is we'll just kind of march our way through the first 15, 16 verses of this chapter and read a little bit, talk a little bit, read a little bit, talk a little bit. That's the way we'll go through this. So Matthew chapter 26, verse 1. When Jesus had finished all these sayings, he said to his disciples, "You know that after 2 days the Passover is coming, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified." Then the chief priests and the elders of the people gathered in the palace of the high priest, whose name was Caiaphas, and plotted together in order to arrest Jesus by stealth and kill him. But they said, not during the feast, lest there be an uproar among the people. Let's just look at verse 1 and 2 for now. Let's just look at this very beginning piece. Jesus had finished these things. He said to his disciples, "You know after 2 days the Passover is coming, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified." Jesus has made a lot of predictions throughout Matthew's gospel about his death, especially when you get to these latter chapters. He's done it in chapter 16, 17, 20, and now here in 26. Prediction after prediction after prediction. It can be easy to think, well, this surprised the disciples, and it did surprise the disciples, but it should not have. Jesus gives pretty clear instructions. This is what's going to happen to me. This is what we're going to do, and the disciples just don't get it. Every time it's said a little bit differently, all of them are pretty specific, but when Mary shows up, and we'll see this here in just a second, the disciples are still pretty clueless. We're going to see this play out a lot more as we go through the next few weeks and we look at the Lord's Supper and we look at the different things there, but it's all over the Gospels. The disciples just don't get it. They've been following around for 3 years at this point. Following him around for 3 years at this point, and Jesus keeps telling them, things are going to go bad, I'm going to be killed, I'm going to come back, but I'm going to be killed. And basically, they just kind of look around at each other, shrug their shoulders like, I don't know what he's talking about. And then they just kind of go on with the rest of their life or whatever task is in front of them. They just kind of keep on trucking. So let that be an encouragement to you in here. those of you that have been following Jesus for a long piece of your life, or those that have just begun to follow Jesus, if there's times where you feel like, I am kind of missing something here. I'm reading through the Bible, I know there's something here, but I'm just kind of missing it. Or you're going through life and you're like, you know what, I'm not identifying the way I should be with this, there's something that should be affecting me, but I'm missing it. You should know, you should be encouraged that even the disciples, as they followed Jesus, went through the same thing. It just didn't always connect for them. The disciples know your pain. You are in good company. But I'll warn you, it's 11 of the disciples that eventually got it. Not all 12 of them. One did not. We'll get there in just a second. Matthew goes on in verses 3 through 5, and he lays out that Jesus was a marked man. And so we see this, the high priest and the elders were, the chief priests were all kind of gathered together, and they were plotting to figure out, how can we get rid of this Jesus? He's threatening our power. He's saying stuff we don't like. He's calling us out. I've had enough of this guy. Let's figure out how to get rid of him. But just earlier, just a day or two earlier, Jesus had come into town on the back of a donkey, and they were saying, Hosanna, blessed be the one who comes in the name of the Lord. They were worshiping him, making a scene there, and so they knew that he had a big following. They knew he was a popular guy, he was a popular teacher, and they knew if they tried to do something in front of everyone else, it would turn on them. They couldn't just arrest him in front of the crowd, because then the crowd would look at Jesus and defend him, come to his defense, and then they would have a mess on their hands. So they knew that this needed to happen in private. And so what we see is that this is happening. This is going on. This is being schemed in behind closed doors. They knew they needed someone that knew Jesus well. Someone that knew his patterns, knew where he would be, knew where he would be teaching, knew the place where you could get him just the right time. They knew they needed an inside guy if they were going to make this happen. But before we get there, Matthew just kind of abruptly stops. See, what would make sense is if we skip over the next four or five verses and just keep on going, because it says these guys were all gathered and they were scheming to kill Jesus. And what would make sense is if Matthew says, and then they met Judas, and then we go on and tell the story of Judas from there. But Matthew stops for a second, interrupts the story, breaks in and says, before we get there, let me tell you about this other lady. Like I said, you can read the other account in John chapter 12, but it's all basically there. And Matthew stops and he says, before we get to that part of the story about Judas, let me show you Mary. Read with me in verse 6. Now when Jesus was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, let's just stop there for just a second. Simon the leper. There's no way that they should be at a leper's house, especially around Passover, because a leper would be unclean. And so the assumption here is that this was Simon the no longer leper. They just call him something different here. He's not the leper anymore. He has no more leprosy. He's been healed. He's been cleansed. And now he's hosting Jesus in preparation for Passover. There's a sermon there that I'm not going to preach right now, but it's a good one. He's not the leper anymore, and now he invites Jesus in for Passover. A woman came up to him with an alabaster flask of very expensive ointment, and she poured it on his head as he reclined at the table. I know this sounds like a really odd situation, like if I'm over at my house just eating dinner and somebody comes and starts pouring some sort of oil on my head, I'm going to freak out just a little bit. Like, this seems a little bit out of the norm, and it was out of the norm, but it wasn't completely as crazy as I think it would be for us. But she comes and she starts pouring it on his head, and when the disciples saw what was happening, they were indignant, saying, why this waste? For this could have been sold for a large sum and given to the poor. Now Matthew says the disciples say this. Matthew, ironically, one of the few times, kind of lets Judas off the hook here, because when you go to John chapter 12, John says Judas is the one that's saying this. Now, is Judas speaking for the rest of the disciples, or is he speaking for himself? We don't really know for sure, but it's Judas that speaks up here, not Peter, who is typically the one who's running his mouth. It's Judas this time. Judas steps up and says, why this waste? For this could have been sold for a large sum and given to the poor. This perfume, as best we can tell, was probably about a year's salary for the average working man. So this was no joke. But Jesus, aware of this, said to them, "Why do you trouble the woman? For she has done a beautiful thing to me. For you will always have the poor with you, but you will not always have me." That does not sound like a very Jesus thing to say, does it? You will always have the poor, but you won't always have me. I think if you hear most people today talk about social justice and the need for social justice, the first thing that they say is we've got to take care of homeless and we've got to take care of the poor. We've got to take care of these people who don't have things. But nowhere is Jesus mentioned in that conversation. I think you have to be careful with that, and we'll look at that more here in just a minute. But that doesn't sound like a very Jesus thing to say. But that's exactly what he says. "In pouring this ointment on my body," verse 12, "she has done it to prepare me for burial. Truly I say to you, wherever this gospel is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her." So you see what's happened there. Jesus is there. He's gathered with his disciples. This woman comes in, pours this on his head. Judas says, "What are you doing? We could have sold that for a ton of money, taken care of a lot of people." Jesus says, "Leave her alone. What she's done is really, really good. What she's done is a beautiful thing." And then he says that she's prepared me for my burial. Again, the disciples probably looking around at each other like, "For my burial? Why does he keep talking about dying? Why does he keep talking about death that is coming?" Jesus says, "This is beautiful. We see this picture of Mary. This is most likely the same Mary of Mary and Martha that we looked at not so long ago. This Mary that wanted to sit at the feet of Jesus while her sister ran around trying to be the good host and take care of things that were around there. But Mary sat to learn, and Jesus told her then that Mary had chosen the one thing that was necessary, is what Jesus said about Mary, to sit at the feet of Jesus and learn from him. And evidently, she had learned much more. We don't know if Mary fully understood the implications of her actions. My assumption is she probably did not. But we know that she was more than willing to do what she did. The bottle of oil, the perfume, would have been so expensive. It stands in stark contrast to so many things that we've looked at here recently. You'll remember just a few weeks ago, the rich young ruler, the one who came to Jesus and said, "I have so much, I've done so many great things, what else do I need to get to heaven?" Jesus says, "Sell everything you've got." And then the story ends, and he went away very sad and sorrowful because he had great wealth. Stands in stark contrast to the rich young ruler. He went away sad because he had much. Here, Mary sees that the fact that she has much, not so much as a barrier to her worship, but an invitation to worship. The fact that she has this rich bottle of perfume is not something that she holds back and says, "I can't follow through here because this is worth so much." Instead, it's an invitation for her to pursue Jesus and to go and to anoint him. Her wealth was an excuse to go worship Jesus, not a hindrance to worship Jesus. Those two set in contrast are a powerful lesson for us. But if that wasn't a sharp enough contrast, we here see the disciples talk about how wasteful she's been and how she's given away too much. We see that Judas is the one that is talking, saying, "Don't be wasting that stuff. Sell it. Take care of the poor. That's the right thing to do." And if Judas were sincere, so let's just assume for a second that Judas is sincere here. If he were sincere, this seems like a legitimate complaint. Now, we know Judas's motives were far from pure, but just for a minute, let's just assume that they are. Let's assume that they're pure. It seems like a legitimate complaint. Like, this would make more sense if from a practical standpoint. Sell it. Let's take care of all these needs that we see around us. What we have to see is what takes precedence over everything in our lives is how we respond to Jesus. Even if what Judas did was sincere, Jesus says, "She's done the right thing here." Jesus wants his disciples to see that he's worthy of this kind of attention. He's worthy of this kind of affection. He's worthy of this kind of praise. No matter how much it costs, he's worthy of it.
Yes, caring for the poor is good. Yes, church ministry is wonderful. Yes, loving your family is great. Yes, serving your community is important. All these things are important aspects of what we do as Christians. Yes, do all of those. But if you don't put Jesus above those things, then you will have sabotaged everything that you're doing right from the very beginning. Jesus must take precedence. He deserves our worship. He's worthy of it. And to pursue anything else, your spouse, your kids, your job, money, comfort, security, feeding the poor, caring for others, any of those things, to pursue any of those things above Jesus, instead of this uninhibited, unrestrained worship of Him, is to choose a path that will ultimately leave you chasing after ghosts that you will never catch. To go after any of those things is to chase after something you'll never be able to take hold of. You must begin with your worship of Jesus. Pursue God, pursue Him, and then from there you move from that place to pursue those things that God has put in front of you. God, help us as a church if we ever pursue being a church and growing in number or doing things to help us get bigger or stronger or more financially secure, if we do it away from worshiping Jesus and apart from Him. And God, help us if we do the same in my family or me personally. We must pursue Jesus first, and then the other things follow from that. To get them out of order will ultimately destroy you and the thing that you're trying to do. Notice too that Mary has no agenda here. She shows up and she has no agenda for Jesus here. She doesn't ask anything of Him. She doesn't come and do anything before that. She's not trying to get into the inner circle. She's not looking to be healed by Jesus. And it's not wrong to come to Jesus asking for things, but here Mary has no other agenda. She didn't want a place of power. If you'll remember last week, we saw where James and John sent Mama to go and talk to Jesus and ask for this. No, this is not what Mary wants. Mary's not trying to kind of wiggle her way in, and she's just there to worship. She was willing to walk in, give over a valuable possession, maybe the most valuable possession that she had, and then let Jesus do whatever He needed to do from there. No agenda. Not asking for anything. Just there to worship. She didn't say, "Oh, now that I've got this taken care of, let me tell you what I need from you." She just worshiped Jesus. Worshipped Him for who He was, not for what He could give. Jesus then lets us know that she was actually preparing Him for burial. She was actually setting the stage for what was to come in just another day or two, what was going to happen, where He was going to die, as He had just predicted, as He had just said, He was going to die, He was going to be buried. And what she has done has set the stage for this moment. She was preparing Him for what would be the greatest moment in history. Her act of selfless sacrifice was the precursor to the ultimate act of selfless sacrifice. And then He says that her story will now be a part of the gospel story to be told by people like me and you on a Sunday morning in March in Jefferson City, Tennessee, 2,000 years later. It's a powerful legacy that she leaves behind, because she chose what was right. She chose what was necessary to just worship Jesus, not because of what He could give, but because of who He was. But her story is part of this story to be told by us, but it's not the only story that gets told here. Matthew gives us another. Let's look at the next couple of verses. Verse 14. "Then one of the 12, whose name was Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, 'What will you give me if I deliver him over to you?' And they paid him 30 pieces of silver. And from that moment, he sought an opportunity to betray him. So we leave the scene of Mary in this beautiful scene that Jesus is celebrating. And then we go and we see Judas doing the backroom dealings with the high priests and with the elders. Moves that will eventually brand Judas as maybe the worst villain in history. Forever known by his act of betrayal, Judas then sets out on this scheme where he will betray Jesus in a secret place where it's kind of hidden off. And Judas sets out on this path that will ultimately get Jesus killed. But I wonder if this is what Judas really intended. Did he intend for this arrest to happen and then for this to ultimately lead to Jesus' murder? Did he intend to see this happen? We don't know exactly why Judas did what he did. We don't have his full motives. There's a couple of things that we can look at that I think are important. The gospel writers never tell us for sure Judas did this because he was upset with Jesus. He did this because Jesus had just called him out in this scene with Mary, and so he wanted to get him back. They never say anything like that. They don't tell us the motives Judas had. But there's a couple of reasons that are hinted at. One of those is money. One of those clearly is money. We've just seen this woman give up a year's salary, and Jesus celebrates this. Judas then immediately takes this turn to betray Jesus. He immediately takes this turn, and he does it over a matter of 30 pieces of silver. Now, if money was his sole motive, this doesn't make very much sense. Because honestly, 30 pieces of silver is just not a lot. It's just not a lot of money. It's a pretty paltry sum. And Judas was the treasurer for the disciples. So for him to get 30 pieces of silver would not have been difficult for him. He could have embezzled that, smuggled that out of the treasury pretty easily. So for him to just do this for 30 pieces of silver does not make a lot of sense. I think the 30 pieces of silver was just icing on the cake that Judas was like, okay, fine, that's enough, I'll do it. It just wasn't that much money. She had given this massively expensive gift, and now you have Judas here that was ready to betray Jesus for such a small amount. Certainly, if we just stop there, that picture is striking just in that contrast there. It's easy for us to talk about Judas. How could you do something like this? Betray a friend, betray Jesus for such a small amount. But how often do we turn our backs on Jesus for so much less? This one that has gone to the cross, that has purchased our sins, how much do we turn our backs on Jesus for something smaller? We don't even need the money to turn our backs. Just a picture on a screen, a moment of anger in a conversation with our spouse, a subtle exaggeration on a resume, a quick look at a friend's paper on a test. There's no shortage of things that we turn Jesus over for in our own lives that don't even add up to 30 pieces of silver. We think that if we could just look a little better, jump a little higher, score a little bit higher on a test, that Jesus would be okay. We will sell Jesus down the river so quickly for such small and trivial things, just for ego checks and these small things. I think Judas wanted the money, but I don't think the money was the main factor. I think he wanted something else even more. Now, I'll be honest with you, I think this is a little bit of speculation, but as I read through the Gospels and I see what the Gospel writers talk about, I see the questions that the disciples ask, I look at Judas and kind of who he was and where he came from. I don't think this is a big speculation, but I think that Judas was at a loss just like the rest of the disciples. He really had no clue what Jesus was there for. He had been following him around for 3 years, and like the rest of the disciples, he was asking stupid questions like, what in the world are you talking about, Jesus? Why are you saying these things about how you're going to die and how you're going to be crucified? That's not what's going to happen to the Messiah. That's not what's going to happen to you. Jesus, this can't be what you're going to do. He was asking those same kind of questions. He was just as confused as the rest of them. But there's something else that he really wanted. And it's why he started following Jesus in the very beginning. He wanted a revolution. He wanted a Messiah that was going to stand up and was going to say, Romans, be gone. High priests, elders, all of you guys that have taken over our faith, be gone, be done. I will come and I will lead the charge and I will bring this nation back to God and I'll take this land that is ours, the military ruler that so much of Israel thought the Messiah was going to be. This is what Judas wanted. There were other guys that were in the 12 that had similar agendas that were called zealots that were there. They were political revolutionaries. That is what they wanted. And that is exactly what they wanted out of Jesus. He wanted Jesus to be the Messiah that he thought he was supposed to be. This idea about serving others and washing others' feet and coming to serve and not to be served and humility and meekness and all this other nonsense. No. This is not the Messiah that I was looking for. I want something else. All this talk that Jesus had increasingly been doing about how he was going to die sounded so weak. This is not the Messiah that was supposed to be here. No way. It's not how this is going to end. Jesus, you can keep talking about how you're going to die, but this is not how this is going to end. We're going to do this. And so Judas seeks out to force Jesus' hand. He goes to find these guys because he wants to start a fight. I'm convinced this is at least a big piece of what Judas's motivation was. He wants to make Jesus fight. He's ready to start the revolution, whether Jesus is or not. And as best I can tell, this is what drove Judas to do what he did. I honestly don't think he wanted to see Jesus get killed. I don't think Judas had any concept of what was about to happen or the gravity of what he had done when he kissed Jesus' cheek that day. I think he thought, just like Peter, that when they came to arrest him, that's when it would be time to throw down. That's when it would be time to fight. Let's do it now. And when that didn't happen, when Judas saw what Jesus did and what was about to happen to Jesus, he ran and he threw his money back in the temple. And you can read on in the Gospels that he eventually killed himself. You see, Judas began following Jesus because he had an agenda. He wanted to see the Jewish revolt. And he wanted to see this Messiah, this Jesus, stand up and lead it. Jesus was just a means to an end. Jesus wasn't the one he was after. It's the revolution that he was after. It was an important end, but Jesus was just the means to an end. The goal for Judas was never Jesus. It was always the revolution. Judas came to Jesus with an agenda, and Judas never laid that agenda down. And that agenda drove him right to the moment where he kisses Jesus' cheek. And so, at least for me, so it is with me far too often. From the moment our lives are conceived, we begin to form an agenda. For some, it's money. For some, it's power. Those were the two big ones for Judas, but for others it's sex or fame or comfort or security or health or kids or family or whatever. You fill in the blank. But we have an agenda of the things that we want and what we think our lives should look like. I don't know what your agenda is, but if you won't lay that agenda down when you come to Jesus, you are no different than Judas. You just don't have to kiss Jesus on the cheek to destroy your life. You just have to hold tight to that agenda. Judas's plans led him down a path that he could not come back from. He betrayed his friend, his teacher, his leader, all so he could get what he thought he really wanted, the revolution. Mary came and gave willingly the most expensive thing she had. She held nothing back. She had no agenda. She just wanted to worship Jesus. Judas came full of agendas, using Jesus to get something else. So what about you? Why are you here this morning? Why are you following Jesus? Is it so your life will be better? Is it so your family will be better? Is it so you'll find comfort and peace? If you're here this morning and that is all your agenda is, hoping Jesus will sign off on it, then you're no different than Judas. For so many of us, our lives are nothing more than everyone else around us. We just want Jesus to sign his name over top of it. And what these two pictures show us is that when you follow Jesus, it's a matter of giving everything over to him, and then you are now on his agenda. Mary came to worship him. Jesus said, "My agenda is that I'm about to be buried. I'm about to be killed and buried." And she says, "Whatever, I'm just worshiping you." She was on his agenda. Christianity is not just doing whatever you want and hoping Jesus likes it. Jesus gets it all. The very best you have and the very least that you have. If all you want is for Jesus to hop on board your train, then you have to stop and see where that train is going. Judas found out real quick that he had not gotten anything that he had bargained for. And so what about you? Where do you see yourself in these two stories? Have you given everything to him, or are you still holding on to this agenda and just hoping Jesus will bless it? Judas is easy to dismiss as the villain, but I'm afraid for many of us, and I know for me, he is the easier one to identify with. And this is what it means to take up our cross every day, to deny ourselves, to die to ourselves, to give up our agenda, to worship him as king, and say, "Wherever you lead, I will go. I will follow you, Jesus." I so badly want Jesus to affirm everything I want. So badly. I want him to affirm it, and I want him to give me a clear path to it. I don't want to struggle. I don't want to suffer. I don't want to give up on the things that I value the most. I just want to see him do what I've wanted for myself all along. But that's not how we worship Jesus. That's how we worship our idols. And so the challenge for us this morning is to respond to Jesus in faith the way that Mary did. To respond and to say, "I want to worship you and you alone. You are the one that I want, Jesus." Will you do that this morning? Will you pray with me? Father, this morning when we hear this message and we know how Judas ended up and we know the villain that Judas is, it is hard when we feel like we identify with Judas. Strip us of those things that we run to and that we cling to instead of you. Help us just to worship you with all that we have, nothing held back. May our worship be as Mary's was to you, a beautiful thing. Show us in our lives where we live too much like Judas. Show us what we have to give up. Show us what we need to let go of so that we can do the beautiful thing and worship you. In Christ's name we pray.